Welcome to Legacy Fundraising Chat, where we talk about everything legacy related to help you as a fundraiser generate more interest amongst your supporters in legacy giving. I'm your host, Sunita Gudu, founder of Persuasion and legacy marketer, providing consultancy, training, coaching and interim legacy support to small to medium-sized charities. I'm delighted that the National Free Wills Network is sponsoring my podcast. They allow you to offer your supporters a free solicitor written will anywhere in the UK, and the charity receives full measurable results. With 15 years of experience and over 500 million raised in future income for charities, the network can help charities of all shapes and sizes launch and maximise their legacy programmes. To find out more, visit nationalfreewills.net. Here's part two of my interview with Tim from Next After. And what I really like about these four criteria, if I can call it that, is that it's so relevant to legacies in terms of trust is such a huge factor as to why somebody would want to, and they need to be absolutely clear about where their legacy is going to go, because any doubt or any confusion will definitely not result in that charity being in someone's will. And yeah, you're right, they do have to completely be exclusive in that space. And which is why also I think donors get confused sometimes, or they're unclear, I guess, the clarity thing. So, I mean, I look at a lot of wills, and often you can see where a donor's been really quite unsure what to do. And so they'll have a number of animal charities. Often there will be wills that have got up to 25 charities. And I think that is a donor who is not clear about what the organizations are going to do. And maybe there is some element of lack of trust, because actually, if this charity doesn't do what I expect them to do, at least maybe one of the others might. I think that really speaks to, and obviously that affects how much income a charity is going to get, because an estate divided by 25 charities is obviously not the same divided between two or three. So I think that's really important.
That's absolutely correct. I think that's an incredible insight. You're absolutely right. I think you're right. They're hedging their bet, so to speak, and making sure that, like, okay, well, if this one doesn't do it, maybe this one will. And so, you know, but if they were really convinced, if they had tremendous clarity about this organization, what makes them different and why their approach or methodology is superior to others, then that charity would receive the lion's share of the estate gift, right?
Completely. Yeah. And you do see that as well. So you'll see one charity that's getting, you know, 70% of the estate, and then the rest is kind of divided between a number of charities. And that's where they're absolutely clear that they trust this organization, they're going to use the legacy wisely, and maybe they're more emotionally invested for whatever reason. I think what would be interesting to know, Tim, from a charity perspective, what can they do in terms of their marketing approach to kind of tap into these, I guess, this criteria when they're putting their messaging out?
Absolutely. So I'm going to give your audience a very strategic exercise that they can do with their board or their staff or even a group of special donors.
Love it.
And then I'm going to give you some ways that you can apply the results of that work to digital fundraising, which is kind of what we do.
Okay. Yeah.
So the first thing is going through and putting together a value proposition workshop. So this is something we do with like every single one of our clients, but this is something that very much you can do yourself. So basically what you do is you get together your board or your leadership team, or even a group of, you know, your high value or highly important donors. And you get them together in a room. And the first step of the process is kind of a brainstorming session. So you're saying, okay, let's all kind of try to answer this question. If I am the ideal donor, why should somebody give to us rather than some other organization or not at all? And just have everybody just kind of list out, here's all the reasons, here's all the claims of value for our organization, and just exhaust that process. Sometimes, you know, when we go through that process, we'll come out of that with 50 or 60 or even 100 or more various different claims of value, reasons why somebody could potentially be motivated to give. So that's the first step of the process. The second step of the process is then you go and give every single person in the room a piece of paper. You number every single one of those claims that you've just identified. And independently, everybody sits there and they go through and they score the perceived appeal of that value claim and the perceived exclusivity. You score them on a scale of 1 to 5 for appeal. If something is highly appealing, this would be appealing to everybody and it's, you know, it's very desirable, it would be a 5. If it's something that's not very appealing to the ideal donor, it would be a 1. Likewise with exclusivity, if something is, you know, if this claim represents something that you do and nobody else does, like that would be a 5. If it's something that everybody else does, it would be a 1. Right. Mm-hmm. So an example of the 1 is like, you know, for example, if you give a gift, you get some sort of tax consideration. Well, that's, you know, that's universal to all organizations. And so, you know, that would be very low in terms of appeal or in terms of exclusivity. Right. So you can kind of see how those two things do. So everybody does that independently. And then when everybody's completed that step of the process, then the facilitator goes around and asks everybody to share their scores verbally. Mm-hmm. And what you're looking for is kind of like a tight grouping of responses. So if I say that the first appeal, I scored the appeal a 5 and I scored the exclusivity a 1. And you said, well, I scored the appeal a 1 and the exclusivity a 5. We're like, okay, hold on a second. We didn't understand what this really meant. We both came to 2 completely different interpretations. And this is one of the ways that you can kind of measure the clarity of the value claim. Mm-hmm. If I perceived it one way, you perceived it a completely different way, that means that this value claim is not clear, right? Okay, so then the final step of the process, once you've scored all your value claims, you're looking for the ones that have the highest appeal and the highest exclusivity. You take your top 5 or 10 of those, and then you're gonna work on the credibility piece. You say, okay, value claim number 1, we scored it very high for appeal and exclusivity. What is the data? What is the facts? What are the figures? Like, what are the endorsements? What are the things that make this in fact true? What are like the third party credibility indicators? You understand? So you're trying to basically kind of get as many different supporters for that claim as you possibly can. And then once you've completed that process, then you take the, you know, your top scored claims and you simply write out a narrative to answer the question. You know, if I am the ideal donor, why should I give to XYZ charity rather than some other organization or not at all? Because, and then you, you know, write out your value claim. And every single effective value proposition should start with the word because, right? Because it is in fact an argument. That's the strategic exercise that everybody should do. And by the way, the value proposition is something that far transcends just digital fundraising or direct response fundraising. This is something that's applicable to every form of fundraising.
Oh, so
this
sure.
is like a really important thing to do.
Completely.
But then the next step is saying, okay, how can we start to test this value proposition? Mm-hmm. We believe that this is what makes our organization different and unique and appealing and credible. But how do we know that that makes sense to our donors? And so then the next step with the process, I would suggest, is starting to test that in your various different communications. A simple way is testing it on your donation page. If that's where everybody goes to make their donation, run an A-B split test. So you take your existing donation page, that's version A, create a new version with this value proposition language, and make that version B. There's lots of technology out there that exists that it'll split the traffic between the two pages and you can track the results. And if your new value proposition produces a 100, 200, 300, 400% increase in conversion, then you're probably onto something, right? So what you're looking for is how that impacts giving.
What if, Tim, you weren't to test it in that live environment? So just thinking about, I guess, legacy giving. So a lot of fundraisers will be creating legacy brochures and leaflets and updating their website. And before they kind of do that work, it can be quite a lot of work. What are your thoughts around getting a kind of group of donors together and having kind of informal discussion? What we do quite a lot in the UK, these kind of like focus groups with donors. Yep. Would you recommend that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we'll typically do is take the results of the value proposition and create a survey. and send that out to our existing donors and get some of their feedback on that. But what we found oftentimes, it's interesting what people say and what they do are often two very different things.
For sure.
And so being able to test it in a live environment gives you so much more clarity around whether or not this actually really works in the real world. And what I would suggest is, like, digital is a pretty low risk place to test that. I mean, if you don't test it on your donation page, test it in an email and just measure, you know, the impact of that email versus what you typically send, and just try to get a sense for, okay, is this something that seems to create some sort of uplift, or is it not make a difference?
That's really interesting. And so is that the complete homework for my listener, or is it another step that they could be taking?
I think if every one of your listeners went through that process, they would find it to be incredibly, you know, valuable. And they would probably find some insights that they never really thought about that makes their organization very attractive from a donor's point of view.
One of the things I wanted to, I guess, rewind on when we were talking about emotion and that rationale. So there's a lot of kind of debate in the UK around positive messaging and imagery versus those kind of like dreary images. And in legacies, we've kind of settled on having very positive imagery that's upbeat, with the idea that the future is much brighter, because people don't want to think of a future that doesn't look better than where we kind of are right now. What's your stance on that?
Well, I mean, we've tested around that, and I will tell you that both can work. It really does depend on the charity, the organization, and really primarily, like, how has the donor base been comprised up to this point? So if they've been doing doom and gloom fundraising forever, going and showing like happy smiling faces typically doesn't perform as well as what the donor has been traditionally used to. So unfortunately, like, it's a long-term project to try to move that. If we really want to move away from that, because a lot of organizations, unfortunately, have been taking this whole, I guess they call it sometimes it's called poverty porn kind of mentality with their fundraising.
And do you feel that in terms of digital, that the future is really about positivity rather than this poverty?
I'm hopeful that it is.
Right.
I mean, I'm an optimist, obviously.
That's
and
good to hear. Yeah.
And so I don't, you know, believe that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. I think it's actually getting better. You know, obviously we have problems and things we're working through, but I think that's because everybody has created a much greater awareness than we've ever had in the past, right? Like, a lot of our, you know, our insights into some of the societal ills was really kind of kept from us for so long, right? I mean, we just didn't have the ways to be able to go and record it and share it and spread it, and not just in my little community here, but, like, you know, challenges that are existing all over the world, right? And so I think that we have so much more access to that, that it's created a greater awareness, and it seems like everything is going, you know, in a negative direction, but I don't think that that's the case, because the more that we become aware, the more that we can inspire people to get involved and be part of the solution, not the problem.
And are you finding that that's what donors are saying, that actually the dreary images, is they find them upsetting, they don't engage with them, and because they can't engage, it means that they aren't necessarily reading the copy and therefore not being persuaded or influenced in any way?
Well, again, this is a perfect example of where, when you ask people what they think, what they say is oftentimes very different than their behavior. When we survey our donors and say, do you want to receive direct mail from us? They're all going to say, absolutely not. Right. But all of those people that said no respond to direct mail pieces. Right. So it's like,
it's the same in the UK with DM. They'll always say no. And I don't know if it's the same reasons there, but here donors think that they're saving the organization money, and they'll say, oh, send me an email version of it. But actually they will respond to a DM piece over an email because they won't read their email. So it's actually ineffective anyway, even if they say that's their preferred method of communication. It's actually completely useless to the organization, because if they're never going to open the alternative comms that they want. We need to go back to their non-preferred communication.
Exactly right.
I'm not sure if this is something that you're able to answer, because I imagine there's quite a lot in this space. I guess, what's the most surprising things that you've heard donors tell you?
I've got some surprising things that we've learned, like through testing. So maybe I'll kind of start with that. But for example, video, right? So you know, everyone's like, video is all the internet is, right? Everybody wants to receive video, and video is much more engaging. It's much more dynamic. It can certainly do a better job of inspiring people to give than text and plain old text.
Right.
But we've tested that over and over and over again. And what we find is there is some truth to that. Yes, video is definitely much more engaging, gets more likes, gets more comments, gets more, you know, views. However, when we've put video on a donation page and tested it versus a text transcript of everything that's contained within that video, what we have found is that the text transcript produces a 500-600% increase in conversion compared to the video. Now, I can't necessarily discern why that is. I have some various different theories. One of my clients, who's the president of a university, and we showed him a test where it was a video that they produced versus the text transcript of the video, is like, I understand why that works. He said, because my reading bit rate is faster than the video playback bit rate. And so by you subjecting me to have to go watch the video, it's very unempathetic, because I can't go create the own pictures inside my head to make the story real and personal to me. I said, well, that's a pretty good answer. I don't know if that's exactly what's going on, but video versus text on a donation page, we have not found that to be an effective way to increase giving. I'll give you another one: email fundraising. So if you look at most nonprofit fundraising emails, they're very highly designed. They've got images and graphics and big clickable buttons. And the problem with that, which everybody does, by the way, is that when a potential donor sees that in their inbox, all they see is somebody trying to market to them, right? And the problem is people don't want to be marketed to. They want to be communicated with. People don't give to email machines. They give to people. So what we've tested, and we've tested this all over the world, like taking your HTML email with all the images and graphics and templates and all that stuff, and stripping all that stuff away, getting rid of the images, the graphics, the buttons, and even rewriting the copy so it's a plain text email that it sounds like it's coming from one human to another human. Well, we tested that 200-500% increase in conversion and response rates to the email when we take that approach. So it's things like that that kind of make you scratch your head and say, man, is everything I learned about marketing wrong? You know?
And I'm just wondering about the whole video thing. Does that vary from organization to organization? I mean, is it the quality of the video, or depending on who's presenting? And is it the audience that maybe an older audience?
I mean, we've tested it with multiple different kinds of organizations and different causes with different demography in terms of their donor base. And we haven't really seen, I mean, we've seen like the difference can be greater. Like in some cases, it's like 100% increase with the text base versus a 500% increase. But we haven't seen that the video has really outperformed the text on just on the donation page. Now, videos on the website and other places and Facebook ads, yes, it produces more opens, more clicks, more people to get to the website. But once you get them there on the page where they can give their gift, having a video there seems to dissuade people from giving as opposed to encourage them to give.
You might have actually saved my listener a lot of money, actually, if they were thinking about creating a video right now. So I think that's absolutely great. And Tim, I'm wondering if there's any research that you've done around legacy pledges and how they behave versus someone that gives a kind of like a one-off donation in terms of their value proposition.
We haven't explored that quite yet. The closest we've kind of got to the whole legacy thing, which is very fascinating to me because it's such a high yield opportunity. I mean, you know, most of the work that we do is what I would consider to be retail fundraising. So this is like the sub $1,000 online transactional gift. But when you're talking about legacy, I mean, obviously, like, you know, one legacy gift could be, you know, 6-7 figures, right? I mean, that's a very high yield opportunity. So some of the things that we've experimented with is doing using marketing automation to create lead generation for legacy gift prospects. I'll give you an example of how this works. So what we'll do is we'll we'll go and you know, do all the kind of data analytics to be able to determine, based on the people we have in our donor database, like, what are the people that are the best prospects to become a potential legacy giver? And because we're using marketing automation, we can make that pool much larger than if we were going to go assign it directly to a gift officer. So in some cases, we'll have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people that are part of that prospect group. And then what we'll do is we will create a series of email and automated voicemail communications from the legacy gift officer, right? That are going to be going out and sending these various different value, I'd say, like, kind of value exchanges, right? So it might be, hey, we just produced this new ebook, I thought you'd be interested in it. Or, hey, here's a really cool story that I just thought you'd be interested in. None of those emails or communications or voicemails makes an ask whatsoever. Right. It's all just about creating kind of like, you know, conversation. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, some of those emails will ask a question. Mm-hmm. And so when the person responds to the email, it goes directly to the legacy gift officer. And now that person has a warm, you know, a warm conversation that has been started with a person. So we're trying to use digital to go from, like, you know, the mass marketing down to creating one-to-one conversations between, you know, legacy gifts folks and their prospects.
And in terms of donor research that you've done, are there kind of some real irritations that donors have about charitable organizations that they share with you or have shared kind of like with your clients that might be universal across organizations? How can organizations be better in terms of serving their audiences?
I mean, I think, unfortunately, one of the big things that a lot of donors communicate is that they have a level of, you know, distrust of the nonprofit industry in general. And they've been, unfortunately, trained by a lot of these, you know, watchdog organizations to expect a very high percentage of every dollar go directly to serve the cause. And the problem with that, which I think, you know, many of us that are kind of insiders and work in the space, is that that is measuring the wrong thing. That's measuring efficiency, not impact. And so the, you know, example I usually give is like, okay, let's pretend that we have two organizations. Both of them are trying to solve, you know, cancer, right? They're both, both trying to create a cure for cancer. One organization is $1 million annual revenue is their budget. And they have a 99% efficiency rate, which means 99 cents out of every dollar goes directly to support cancer research. The second organization is a $100 million organization, and their efficiency is 50%, right? So 50% out of every dollar goes directly to cancer research. Which one is making a bigger impact? One that has $50 million of impact, or the one that has $999,000 of impact? And the problem is as organizations scale, like, so must their overhead. They need to have more people in place. They need to have more marketing systems to be able to go sustain a $100 million annual budget. And so making the argument that, like, you know, I want this organization that's going to solve one of the biggest challenges in the world, which is, you know, cancer, to kind of do it on a shoestring budget is just absolutely illogical and impossible. So that's some of the stuff that I think that unfortunately a lot of donors still hold on to. And they look at those little pie charts and how much is going to fundraising and overhead and all this stuff. And I think that that's, you know, kind of looking at the wrong stuff.
Totally. And I think as a sector, we've been pandering to that in some respect, because we provide donors with that information. We'll say 85% goes to directly towards delivering services and 15%. Then we try to justify the 15%. And we say, obviously, we need money for administration, we just pay staff, etc. So I guess, what's the alternative? What can the charity do instead of giving those pie charts and explanations?
I'd say focus. What we found is focus on the value proposition.
Explain
to the donor why you're different and why you're approaching it differently. Like, explain to them. I think this is one of the big things that came out of, like, the pandemic is that a lot of donors were really looking at how organizations were pivoting during that time, how they were reimagining how they deliver their social impact to the, you know, to the society. And so I think that that's an opportunity for us, is to really kind of focus on innovation, not just doing the same old, because we've always done it and because we know it works, but trying to really kind of take some calculated, you know, risks so that we can try to figure out the next breakthrough.
And what I'm really hearing from this is, even if a charity is able to say that their costs are low, it doesn't actually mean that they're making any impact. Maybe that's the messaging that we need to be giving to donors, is that the higher the cost, as you've said, might actually be because the impact is so much more. Like you said, you can't create something out of nothing, can you?
That's correct. But I wouldn't necessarily like lean into, you know, kind of you're drawing attention that you have
a
larger share of overhead. I would just really focus on the impact side of that.
Previously, we talked about often donors give behavioral cues as to how they might feel about an organization or how they are likely to give or not give.
Yes.
Is there anything around that you could share with my listener that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked that question, because this is unfortunately one of the challenges of really just any organization, for profit, nonprofit, and that's the fact that like we're so often motivated by our own self-interest, right?
Mm.
We want people to give. We want people to increase their giving. We want to grow our organization. We want all these things, right? And we fail to really kind of pay attention to what the donors are communicating to us through their behaviors. Because we're so focused on the things we want, we have all these KPIs or these key performance indicators and things that we're tracking, but we're not paying attention to the negative KPIs. So for example, I send an email, I'm looking at how many people open my email. That's my email open rate. Mm-hmm. But I guarantee you, for every single one of your listeners and their organizations, their non-open rate is much higher than their open rate. And if you pay attention to that, then you can kind of say, okay, what do I need to change? What do I need to do? What do I need to test to try to get more people to open my email? And that could lead you to start testing new and different things. And this is where, you know, I kind of get on my soapbox, because this is what we do every single day, is we're constantly testing, because I have come to the conclusion that I am not a fundraising expert. Nobody is. The only fundraising experts are the donors themselves.
Mm.
And so what we need to do as, you know, leaders in the area of fundraising is we need to put ourselves in a position to become students of the donors and really learn based on understanding how our donors are responding to the various different things we're putting in the marketplace. So I would say this is where like data analytics becomes incredibly valuable, like listening to how your donors are responding by looking at what their behaviors are, right? Are they opening? Are they clicking? Are they lapsing? Are they not giving anymore? Did they, you know, used to give at this rate, now they're have they downgraded, right? These are all like things that we can use to try to understand, you know, our donors, and then start testing ways to reverse those trends.
And Tim, is there anything else that would help my listener in terms of bringing everything that you've talked about today, especially the homework that we've given the listener around the value proposition? Is there anything else that they need to know?
No, I would tell you that there's probably some resources that I could provide, especially in the area of value proposition. So
right.
we produced a study several years ago where we contacted 127 different organizations across 8 different verticals, and we asked them the value proposition question.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked it across 4 different channels. So we called them on the phone. We sent an email to them through their contact us form on their website. We direct messaged them on Facebook. And then we took a snapshot of what their donation page had to say to answer the value proposition question. We scored it all. And I think that would be a great study for everybody to go, you know, take a look at. You'll find mm-hmm. some pretty alarming trends and some pretty important opportunities to really optimize value proposition. So if you go to the website, I think it's called the Why Should I Give to You study, the Value Proposition Index study. And that would be a great primer for everybody that's listening.
That's super. And I'll pop that in the show notes for our listener. So Tim, it's been absolutely wonderful interviewing you. I think we've covered so much, and we can definitely have spoken for a lot longer, but I think we've given the listener quite a lot to do. So maybe if you do some more research within the legacy kind of like space, it'd be great to have you back on the show if you're willing.
That would be wonderful. I'd love to.
That's great. Thank you so much, Tim. Much appreciated.
All right. Thank you so much.
That, my listener, is all for this episode. There's lots there to digest and implement. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Thank you so much for tuning in to Legacy Fundraising Chat, brought to you by Persuasion, providing consultancy training and coaching to help fundraisers just like you. Thank you for everything that you do for your charitable organisation and the third sector. making it an inspiring place to work. I'm your host, Sunita Gudu, champion your legacy fundraising efforts.